This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The weather forecast this week is hot. San Antonio will be in the upper 90s. North Texas will be even hotter. Dallas hit 100 degrees yesterday, with more of that coming. So far this summer, the big heat wave story has been in the Pacific Northwest, where they experienced record-breaking temperatures and hundreds of deaths in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. This week, a heat dome is parking itself over the Midwest, will expand the mercury and cause wildfires and heat deaths there. And this punishing heat isn't like Shakespeare's Quality of Mercy. This is indeed strained. People who live in low-income communities are more likely to experience even hotter temperatures because of the urban heat island effect. So how aware are you of this problem of extreme heat in our communities? Are you concerned about the impact on our neighborhoods? People who work outdoors, how are they going to cope with this? How serious of a threat is extreme heat to public health and mental health? We want to hear how you deal with this. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And you can tweet at us at TPRSource or email us at thesource@tpr.org. And that number, you can text us at that, 833-877-8255. We're joined this hour to discuss extreme heat. We're joined by Christy Eby, PhD, epidemiologist and professor in the Center for Health and Global Environment at the University of Washington. And Christy Eby, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much for having me join.
Also with us, Dave Nyogi, PhD, professor in the Departments of Geological Sciences and of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And Professor Nyogi, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Rebecca Brendel, MD, Director of the Master of Bioethics Program and Associate Director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School and President-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. And Dr. Rebecca Brendel, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. I'm pleased to be here.
So I want to We're going to have to wrap in two big ideas in today's program. One of them is talking about how different communities deal with this in a city. We know that areas that are low income, they're dealing with this urban heat island effect. They're going to have hotter days than the rest of the city. We need to talk about how this impacts those communities, but also overall the public health aspect of this, how we can have to recognize this of those and ourselves and around us, of how, you know, heat exhaustion is a real thing and people need to be on the lookout for that. So Christy Eby, can you talk about heat exhaustion? What are the warning signs?
Thank you. It's a really good question. It's not easy for many people to tell that they're getting into trouble with the heat, that as our bodies get warmer, we have mechanisms to try and reduce the internal heat around our organs, which we need to protect. The one most people are familiar with, of course, is sweating. But as that becomes ineffective because of very high temperatures, both external and internally generated, then our cells and our organs start heating up. They don't like working in very hot temperatures.
And this also is an impact on people's mental health as well. Dr. Brendel, can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, we all know when we're hot and it's hot outside, we can be prone to become cranky or a little bit irritable or even sometimes lethargic, feel like we're not thinking as clearly. And those are normal things that can happen during extreme heat. But there can also be much more serious health consequences, both medically, as you began to hear about, in terms of mental health, and also in terms of community health. But the things to really look out for are levels of stress, anxiety, and depression. There's also can be increases in substance abuse and in interpersonal violence. And so we really have to be cognizant of the need to maintain our connections to others, to monitor ourselves, to come up with ways to ensure that we can maintain ourselves as mentally healthy as possible, and also to seek resources when we need them.
Dave Nyogi, you're looking at heat islands and how this is, you know, when we have a heat wave in a city, you can have even many heat waves in that same city. Is that what you're looking at?
Right. I mean, when we think about heat, clearly it is a weather and climate issue. And we think about these large heat domes that create regions which are extremely hot over certain areas. But even as you look at those areas, you'll find that cities, because of the urban heat island, which is caused because of the emissions, because of the infrastructure, are already 8 to 10 degrees hotter than the surrounding non-city regions. And so now you have a one-two punch on the communities with the large-scale heat and the local-scale heat making things even more worse.
I'm thinking about here in San Antonio, we have the Alazan Apache Courts, which is a public housing project built in 1930s, cinder block housing, no air conditioning, 700 units still being used today. And it seems like that would be a place where you would see that urban heat island effect, Professor Nyogi.
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about urban heat, I think you raised this discussion right. We often think about it as a meteorological climate issue, but it is, of course, a health, well-being, economy, and above everything, an environmental justice issue. In many regards, the communities which are most vulnerable are also the communities which are at the highest brunt of this problem.
Let's go back to Christy Ebi. You got cut off due to gremlins and the technology, but I want to finish up what you were saying about how serious this is. People need to recognize and monitor themselves to make sure they don't fall victim to heat exhaustion.
Yeah, apologies for the gremlins. I don't know where I got cut off, so I don't want to repeat for the audience what I've already said. Did I talk about our core body temperature?
Yeah, that's where you got cut off, but if you could just tell me about what is a warning sign to look out for. I've heard about clamminess. Is that something?
One of the first symptoms that people are getting into trouble with the heat is they're getting confused, which is not a terribly helpful symptom. And the extent to which we recognize these symptoms varies by age. A natural part of the aging process is people are less well able to tell they're getting into trouble with the heat. So people really do have to pay attention to how they feel and to check in on families, friends, and colleagues that are in high-risk groups.
All right, we're going to talk more about that. Who's most at risk for heat-related illnesses? Heat is a stressor, which can magnify other problems that you have physically and also with your mental health. What can be done to sort of offset the urban heat island effect and why that should be part of city planning and why investments in that would be help individuals. And the redlining, which was a racist policy that hurt communities of color, is we see that the urban heat island effect is duplicated in those red lines. So what to do about that? If you got a question or a comment, call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. To The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about extreme heat. We think we're used to it here in South Texas, but it's going to get worse. And there are other parts of the country that are not used to it. And they're getting heat that would just, I just can't even believe that that's happening, like in the Pacific Northwest, where we've seen actually fish dying, shellfish dying, people dying. This is a deadly phenomenon. Heat is among the deadliest of all weather disasters. It takes more lives than blizzards, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, but it's not a very well understood phenomenon. We don't track it very well. What can we be doing to better understand these heat islands, these heat domes, and how are we going to help the poor and vulnerable who are exposed to the brunt of this. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Rebecca Brindell, Dr. Brindell, I want to talk to you about what this means for people who are dealing with mental health. We know that when you have stressors put on to people, that their problems become magnified. And that includes people who are dealing with things like schizophrenia. Have we seen that extreme heat can also be a trigger for that?
Well, what we do know is that extreme heat, as you heard from my colleague just a few moments ago, can lead to changes in the ways all our organs function, and the brain is no exception. So what we do know is that as the average temperature increases, we see increased rates of suicide and we see increased rates of interpersonal violence. What we also see is that those who have existing mental health disorders are disproportionately impacted by the consequences of climate change, especially for individuals who have histories of anxiety or post-traumatic stress, have had a large trauma burden early in their lives. The added stress of heat can lead to profound symptoms, worsening of symptoms, even depression, and exacerbations in substance abuse. We also have one additional area that we need to focus on, which is that some medications, you mentioned in particular schizophrenia, some medications that are used for treatment of major mental illness can also make people more susceptible to having medical consequences from heat because they're not able to regulate their body temperature as well. So lots of different effects, both from treatments and underlying conditions and the stress just of heat itself.
So it's well known that when we have a heat wave, that there's also an increase in crime, and the police departments that we've seen this reported that there's an increase in domestic violence. Is this people who are stressed out and they're on a shorter fuse, and sometimes you don't see the best of them when you put individuals in that situation. So is that something else to be concerned about, Dr. Brindell?
Yes, it's absolutely something to be concerned about just in terms of agitation and aggression that can occur in response to extreme heat. Also, right, because extreme heat is linked to the use of alcohol and other intoxicating substances, those substances themselves, substance use itself is a risk factor for aggression and violence. So there can be this snowballing or additive effect of a response to extreme heat and then increased violence. The other piece I haven't yet added in is that heat can make it difficult for people to sleep. And so we all know that not sleeping enough can lead us to become irritable, not to be able to make as good decisions, to become short and more impulsive. And so we have to be aware of that as well.
Christy, Ebi, we just heard from Dr. Brindell telling us about people who sometimes use more alcohol. They try to hit the beers to cool off. But what is the impact of alcohol and the body during extreme heat? All right, we're having problems with that connection. So Dave Nyogi, if you could talk about how we know that people with mental illness also are more likely to live in poverty in low-income areas. And what is happening in these areas that makes them hotter?
Well, you sort of touched on this issue that these many of the areas which have not seen infrastructure development consistent with some of the more affluent areas are places where there is lesser tree cover. There might be lesser time to access. It might require more time to access certain facilities and resources publicly. So you also might have a lack of for air conditioning or any of these things that we take for granted in the context of a hot, sunny period or, you know, in a hot summertime condition. So the lack of access to resources just individually or as a community are deeply embedded within the whole fiber of that region. And that just makes things worse. And those could also be the regions where there might be, as you mentioned, a scenario where some of these stressors might act to exacerbate some of the other social problems. So it becomes much more complex going forward.
It's just walking across a parking lot during a hot summer's day, and you can feel the heat coming from the asphalt. It tells you right there you've experienced the urban heat island effect. Just think, what does that mean for an entire neighborhood, that they don't get the evening cooling because it's always hot because of all of the heat that has been absorbed by concrete and asphalt, and they don't have the shade. So neighborhoods that have been redlined are hotter than those that were not. That's according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. Counties with large African-American populations are exposed to extreme temperatures 2 to 3 times more days per year than counties with smaller African-American population, according to their research. And that with climate change, those same neighborhoods are expected to have 20 more extreme hot days by 2050. So is this a climate change story, Dave Nyogi?
You know, that's interesting. You are raising a point that when we look at future climate projections, we have always relied on the facts that, you know, the climate models will tell us that there's going to be higher frequency, higher duration, and more intense extremes. And that is true for extremes such as in temperature, both the winter storms as well as the heat waves. But what is even more interesting is that just recently, there have been studies which have shown that if you single out the cities, and if you consider the effect of climate and the city together, then the probability that they are going to have extreme heat increases by almost 200 to 2,000 times that they will be impacted by heat wave or a heat-related extreme. When you look at the scenario going forward. So yes, it is definitely a climate signature, but not just in terms of the large scale climate, but also very much embedded within what is happening in the cities themselves.
Christy Ebi, we have you back now. I wanna go to you for the answer for that question about consumption of alcohol to cool off during these extreme hot days, and what does that do to the body?
And I hope you can hear me this time.
Yes, I can.
That's great. It's a good question. We do have to stay hydrated when it's hot. Alcohol does not hydrate. In fact, alcohol dehydrates people. So enjoy your beers, but make sure that you drink much more water than normal so that you can stay hydrated and help protect your body during the heat.
So what happens to a person who gets dehydrated? I've heard that thirst is a lag indicator, that you may not notice that you're thirsty. Actually, your body was thirsty, you know, 10 minutes ago when you finally realized that you're thirsty.
You're absolutely right. And many older adults are marginally dehydrated on a good day anyway. So getting people to drink more water quite regularly during heat waves is one of the important things that people need to do, in addition to finding places where they can cool down, whether it's in the shade, in front of a fan, with putting some water on your skin, to, if you really need to, have air conditioning so that you can keep that core body temperature within the effective range.
So the idea is your body will sweat, and then the evaporation of the sweat cools the body down. This is an adaptation that humans have. But Christy Ebi, when the humidity is so high, then your sweat does not evaporate. I've heard this described as the wet bulb effect, and that is a dangerous combination: high heat, high humidity.
High heat and high humidity is dangerous. I will note that it takes about 24 hours of high temperatures before we start seeing an increase in mortality. During that 24 hours, when people are in these situations of high heat and high humidity, there does need to be periods where they can bring the core body temperature down. You mentioned at the beginning outdoor workers.
deep concern about people who work out in very hot conditions. There are three states that have regulations to protect workers during these conditions, and that does mean drinking more water and making sure that they spend time resting in the shade, cooling down from those hot conditions.
Rebecca Brindell, what about folks who live outside, living rough, as they say, you're homeless? How do they deal with that?
Right, that's such an important point because homeless persons are particularly susceptible to the negative effects of extreme heat and have the fewest resources and options to be able to cool down and find places to do that. So it's really important that we think of this problem as a community and think about the kinds of resources that we can make available to support those who have the least access, especially to the extent that undomiciled people often congregate in urban areas. So making water stations available, making cool down spaces, public areas available, having check-ins by medical or public health personnel in areas where it's known that homeless individuals find shelter or relative safety, to make sure that they're aware of the risks and have the ability to access these important resources to stay safe.
And then there is, we already talked about that, if you're dealing with some sort of mental illness already, we know that is something that is evident in many folks who are living out on the streets. That's, so this is a bad combination.
Yes, it's a really dangerous combination, and it's a combination that requires a lot of attention to make sure that those who are already most affected by social determinants of health are not, again, disproportionately affected as we see these extreme temperatures, and to make sure that we're addressing all the different causes of difficulties in physical and mental health, at medical and psychiatric conditions.
Right. And so what are the indicators, that people who come in contact with the homeless should be, be aware of, particularly police?
Right. Well, again, the same warning signs that you heard of dangerous conditions, medical and psychiatric from extreme heat, would apply to those who are homeless as well. So really important, right, to think about if you have to carry things with you and you're wearing many, many layers of clothing, to think about where finding safe spaces where belongings might be able to be left so individuals don't feel like they have to take everything with them and then be burdened by more belongings and clothing in order to keep it safe, but then again, to become overheated. And also to really make mental health resources available, check-ins, and to have people who are trusted within the community available to do check-ins and maintain community connections and symptom monitoring.
So listeners, are you worried about the physical and mental health impacts of our worsening heat waves? Well, how is extreme heat impacting your life? Are you having a harder time coping with the daily life or your job? Do you work outside? Are you concerned about more severe heat? The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about extreme heat, the impact on physical, mental health, and what's happening in our communities. We want to know what you have seen in your experience and also what needs to be done with dealing with climate change. We're going to be focusing our attention now to how this is a climate change issue, and you can join in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And so that we do know that more than 200 of the world's leading climate scientists will begin meeting today to finalize a landmark report summarizing how the Earth's climate has already changed, and this is due to because of the carbon that humanity has been pumping into the atmosphere, and what can humans expect for the rest of the century? Dave Nyogi, professor in the Departments of Geological Sciences and Civil Architectural and Environmental Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, it looks pretty grim.
It is. Especially if you look at it in the context of the cities, what I would like to highlight again is that what we are seeing from the climate models is likely an underestimation of what is going to be happening and is happening in the cities. So we have to look at not at the middle of the road scenario, but really the extremes of the extremes to try and understand what we're dealing with.
You know, not everyone has air conditioning or can afford to run the air conditioner that they have. In the Pacific Northwest, they had power outages. So if you had electricity and you had money to bank to pay for it, to pay for the air conditioner, you couldn't run it. Today, we're expecting ERCOT to hit an all-time high power consumption. We probably will get some notifications asking people to cut back and conserve their power usage. You know that this is going to be hitting people hard as a climate justice issue. Christy Eby, a professor at the Center for Health and Global Environment at the University of Washington, what do people need to be thinking?
Cities, communities need to be planning for how to manage these events. We heard a little bit about cooling centers. They are an important option for cities when you have these extreme heat waves. There's a lot of planning that goes into developing these, ensuring that you have essentially an all of society preparation, everything from education and training of individuals to ensuring you've got collaboration between your city departments, your fire departments, ambulance services, people who reach out to the unhoused, people who monitor elderly care facilities, so that you know before an event happens where the cooling centers are going to be, ensure that they're close to those most at risk, and knowing how they're going to get there and how long they will be open. Should they be open all night, for example, if you're going to have a very hot night when you don't have a chance to cool down your core body temperature?
Rebecca Brendel, Dr. Brendel, you're at the Center for Bioethics, and this is an ethics situation at Harvard Medical School. We have a responsibility to, first of all, help each other in these extreme circumstances that we know is taking lives. But what about the dealing with climate change as a community responsibility?
Right. That's such an important point that you bring up, because there's no way for any one of us to make a major impact unless we come together to do things to reverse or at least slow down the rate at which we're experiencing climate change. And so there are a number of things that we can do, both to address the effects of climate change now. That's something that the American Psychiatric Association does actively through its Climate Change Committee, and as well as looking at the effects of climate change, such as natural disasters, on mental health, how traumatic those can be, especially for those who already have mental illness. And then thinking about the kinds of things we can do in the course of our business and our life to be able to make a commitment to reversing the trend. So the APA, like many other organizations, has stopped investing in fossil fuels. We've recently moved our headquarters in Washington, D.C., and we chose a LEED gold-certified building. And also now, post-COVID, we're thinking about the ways in which we might be able to cut down on the carbon footprint from employees traveling to work with virtual work, and also really looking at the feasibility of continued virtual work and continuing to cut down on our travel. So I think this is something that we can do in small ways and in big ways, but it's definitely something that if we don't come together to do it, it's a problem of a global public good, something that we must all come together to affect, or it's not going to happen.
Let's go to the phone lines, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to join us to discuss your thoughts on climate change and extreme heat, let's go to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, David. A good program and certainly very necessary discussion. I want to talk particularly about Texas' role in promoting more emissions. I think that Permian Basin is emitting more methane at this point in time than any other shale play in the country and possibly the world. And then also our state policymakers are gung-ho with industrial development all along the mid-Texas coast. We have the world's largest ethane cracker under construction now, just north of Gregory, which is north of Corpus Christi. We also have Cheniere LNG plant exporting natural gas, which is proclaimed to be a clean fuel, and it really is not when you look at what it takes to get it out of the ground. It's directly related to methane releases and flaring and other kinds of emissions that contribute to the destruction of the ozone layer. Plus, we have the world's largest plastics plant in Port Lavaca, or near Port Lavaca, also the mid-Gulf Coast. And plastics, we know, cover a large segment of oceans around the world, and they contribute to containing warmth in the ocean. So Texas can take credit or discredit for a lot of contributions to the problems we are seeing around the globe for global warming. We need a change in policy, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for that call. Dave Nyogi at the University of Texas at Austin, your program is part of an overall attempt to document and show how the we are seeing global warming here in Texas?
I want to highlight one important thing here, that when we look at the heat and the urban heat, there is, of course, the notion of the large-scale greenhouse gas-driven aspects. And there are these large bodies, including the IPCC, or what would be done through the regulations on where this emission should be controlled or how they should be regulated, keeping in view the development and the economy. But there is something in addition to that that the communities can do at a much local scale, and that is the power of adaptation. And one of the things that I want to highlight to the audience and just note that we don't need to wait for larger communities and organizations to try and solve community scale problems. We need to have partnerships in place. And that's exactly what we are trying to do, working with the NOAA, National Integrated Heat, Health, and Information Systems, the NIHIS, about trying to map cities, trying to understand what partnerships can help in terms of developing the solutions. So adaptation is clearly really important as we start to problem at the issue of and large-scale climate.
And we have an anonymous text message. It says approximately 1 in 4 Texas prisons are air-conditioned. Temperatures in the units that do not have AC have registered at 140 degrees. This is inhumane. Dr. Brendel, how can at 140 degrees, can a person survive that?
Well, eventually 140 degrees is going to be a problem. And the real issue here is thinking about health equity and mental health equity within correctional settings. We know that many individuals with mental illness receive treatment through the correction system, especially in large cities. And so we need to be very, very cognizant both about the susceptibility of those who have mental illness and who are in custody and don't have an option to be able to find other places to make sure that their basic health needs are safeguarded.
Right. And but the bioethics of being subjecting people to that sort of circumstance.
Right. And so, again, you know, the thinking ethically, like as we heard earlier, for individuals in any kind of institutionalized setting, we have a particular responsibility for those we've taken into our custody and care. And certainly That includes the basic elements of safety, physical safety, and health safety within those institutions. So from an ethical standpoint, absolutely, temperatures that are incompatible with health and safety are something that we must address.
All right, we're taking a break. What are your concerns about more severe heat and what it can mean for your energy bills and personal health? These droughts and heat domes, heat waves, they're going to become more frequent, more extensive. They're going to be higher temperatures. They're going to last longer. This is a changing environment, asking people to adapt to this. What is that going to look like? What should be done to protect vulnerable populations, including the elderly and people experiencing homelessness? What do you want to see done about climate change? What are you willing to do about it personally in your life? Are you willing to park that gas-burning car, get an EV instead? What can be done to deal with these heat waves? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about extreme heat and the impacts on us physically and mentally. This does have a stressor effect on us. It's going to shorten lives, some more than others. People who live in communities where they're going to experience hotter temperatures more frequently, and it varies from inside a city. It can vary as much as 5-10 degrees, depending on the urban heat island effect and what can be done about that. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. Let's go over to Christy Eby. Now, you're the epidemiologist, professor in the Center for Health and Global Environment at the University of Washington. Now, Washington is where we saw a lot of the stories about this heat wave that y'all guys got. And I'm wondering if the Huskies are going to have to change their mascots to a hairless chihuahua because it was so hot up there.
Not yet. We're pretty committed to keeping the Husky as the mascot, but very cute.
But so, I mean, is there a concern that this could be a new normal for you guys?
Everywhere, as you heard before, we'll see increases in the frequency, intensity, and duration of heat waves. The Pacific Northwest and Canada have seen very few heat waves, but we are heading into a future where we will see more. Whether we see more intense heat waves like the one that we just experienced will depend, as you've heard from others, on our greenhouse gas emissions.
So, and so Dave Nyogi at the University of Texas at Austin, I'm hearing people talking about, you know, the jet stream is not as strong as it had been because of global warming. And so that's trapping hot air below it, or what is happening?
Yeah, when we think about climate, we essentially think about the greenhouse gases, and it's pretty clear that the greenhouse gases absorb heat and then that heats up the atmosphere. But there is a second factor that is also at play here. And in fact, my colleague here at UT, she makes a very nice analog about how you can think about it from the cycle pump. If you have ever pumped air for in a cycle tire or in a ball, you can see the pump actually heats up. So when you have a high pressure system, you have more heat being trapped or heat being generated, so to say. And so that is a dynamic feature. So when we are looking at things like how the jet stream, which I call as a conveyor belt of all the storms going across America and the globe, in fact, creates a situation of this increased dynamic heating. So we have the large-scale climate change, we have the variability due to the dynamics, and then we have, for the cities, a very local-scale urban heating, just making this problem extremely multi-scale and complex.
So, and that's also explains why we here in Texas, we had that winter storm in February, where the jet stream allowed a big blob of cold air, Arctic air, to come down here and sit on top of Texas for a while.
Absolutely. In fact, the jet stream, you can think about it sort of like a barrier. When I try to explain it in my class, I try to say that north of the jet stream, and the jet stream is roughly about 10 miles, so to say, above the atmosphere, above the ground surface, but it still acts as a barrier. That north of it, we typically assume things are going to be colder. South of it, things are going to be warmer and perhaps more humid. And so when that things gets locked, you can expect either when the jet stream moves way down south, you can imagine like the fridge door being left open and you're going to get all the cold air down. On the other hand, when it starts moving all the way higher up north, you can imagine like the heat radiator being blown northwards and all the heat going and getting trapped there. So jet stream does have a dynamic way of modulating the temperatures, and that's a good example. So in fact, what we learned from the winter storm as to how we can have a cascade of effects, similar things unfortunately start unfolding for heat waves with a failure in the systems, and then the hazard starts becoming a disaster.
Now, so Rebecca Brendel, you're a doctor, an MD, so let me ask you about these death certificates and how that we do have people who die in from heat exhaustion, but frequently death certificates don't have that a heat-related element in the final documentation. Is that true?
Well, I can't comment specifically about that in death certificates because it's not my area of expertise. I don't fill out many of them and I haven't studied them extensively. But what I can say is that often what in our experience in some small work that our students did at our center, there's often something on a death certificate that is medically true in terms of the immediate cause of death, but it certainly may miss the circumstances that were occurring at the time or other related or associated features. So it's a really important point in doing the research. And my colleague, Dr. Ebay, with her background in epidemiology, could probably say more about this, about how we use the data that we get, the medical data, to be able to study other environmental causes that might have influenced it.
All right, so let's go to Christy Ebay on that. And so it seems like there is missing data, that we're not recording what's actually happening around us, or are we?
Those are very good questions. When people die in the United States, we're required to have a death certificate. Somebody needs to fill this out. And the death certificate has a line where somebody writes in what the underlying cause of death was, and then some contributing factors. And what physicians, healthcare providers do when they complete a death certificate is they put down the medical reasons around a heart attack, for example. But they do not put in the environmental conditions. So what happens after a heat wave is once the death certificates are collected, they then go through a process of harmonization to make sure that everyone's consistent in how the death certificates are coded. Then epidemiologists use these death certificates to analyze the number of excess deaths. And this is the total number of people who died during a heat wave over what you would expect during a similar time in a previous year. And this captures the heart attacks that were brought forward in time or that would not have happened anyway without the excess heat. And so then we can get a much truer impact estimate from the heat wave without just counting the people who died from heat stroke.
But there is some sleuthing that's going on to come up with that data. Can we do a better job of making it evident?
It does take a while in the United States to get death certificates. Other countries have a more rapid process. And once we have those death certificates, there's people who die in the heat from heart disease, from respiratory disease, kidney disease. There's a whole range of different kinds of underlying pathologies that are affected by heat. And so we need to look at the total number of people who died
to get that estimate and then to use that information to improve our early warning systems, to improve how we design and provide access to cooling centers, for example.
Dave, Nyogi, people just think it's hot. You know, it gets hot. We're in South Texas. What do you think is going to happen? But they're not really seeing that we have more days that are over 100 degrees and that there's only, and we're going to have more.
Yeah, unfortunately, very often people who are suggesting this is not a problem are people who are not exposed to the problem. And it is very important to have a conversation with the communities that are actually at the brunt of it, and also finding ways to measure the problem such that we are not going just by perceptions, but also by local data, which is hard to come by, but we are getting there. And I hope we can develop systems that can help everyone make informed decisions, because ultimately this is a thing we all have to confront to. It is not going to just go away.
And Dr. Rebecca Brendel, so what's your response when people say it's hot, deal with it, or just turn on the AC and, you know, live life?
Well, we can say, yes, it is hot, and let's be prepared for the heat. Let's do everything we know how to do to create resources, to provide public education and health literacy around some of the risks of heat and how to prepare ourselves for it and keep ourselves safe. And then let's also think collectively about the community engagement and the partnerships that we can build, especially with the most at-risk communities, so that we can lessen the mental and physical health effects of heat.
And Dave, Nyogi, I mean, there are parts of the world that are dealing with heat much worse than we have here in the United States, and it is having a profound impact. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. But I just wanted to pick up on the previous comment that the value of community partnership that were raised, that is probably one of the most important things that we really need to highlight, that we can come up with almost anything, but unless we have a chain and a community together, this is not going to be solving. And indeed, you're right. This problem is not just a Texas problem. This is not just a community here. It is a global problem, and we have to have a local as well as global solutions.
All right, I want to thank all of our guests. That was Dave Nyogi, PhD, endowed professor in the Departments of Geological Sciences and of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. We also heard from Christy Ebi, the PhD, epidemiologist, professor in the Center for Health in the Global Environment at the University of Washington. Go Huskies. And Rebecca Brendel, MD, professor of the Master's of a Bioethics Program and Associate Director in the Center for Bioethics at Harvard University. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Xiaowen Chan, TPR's summer arts intern. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.